how must he do that? He must do that by fixing his mind on one point. Just one point. Then as he's doing that, he's expected to hold his neck, his body, as well as his head very erect, in a straight line. And he's expected to stare steadily at the tip of his nose. That's why you see pictures of yogis, their eyes are not fully closed. They tend to be half closed. And with that kind of unagitated mind, he must become devoid of fear. He must become completely free from sex life. He must meditate upon Krishna, God, within the heart. And then he must make that object of his worship the ultimate goal of his life. These are just 2-3 verses from the Gita. Arjuna decided by the time Krishna spoke these 4 verses that this system of yoga that you have summarized appears 1, impracticable, and 2, it's very difficult. Why? Because Arjuna told Krishna, Krishna, who is able to sit on kusha grass today? Who has the time? Who has the time to hold his mind steady in a peaceful and sacred place? Singapore is no such place. Most of us are just too busy waking up in the morning, brushing teeth and having a breakfast is good enough, rushing to work. When are we ever going to find this time to do exactly what the 4 verses before actually said? So the speaker of the Gita, Krishna, heard Arjuna, who was going to be a yogi, speak these words. And Arjuna said, you know what? I think this is impractical. And I thought the Gita was supposed to be practical. So Krishna, the mind is so restless, it is so unsteady. Do you seriously think that the mind can be controlled in this manner? And do you seriously think that I, mind you, Arjuna was a fighter. He was on the battlefield when Bhagavad Gita was spoken. He was just an hour or two away from fighting. How would a warrior be able to sit quietly and peacefully amidst such disturbance, such material conditions? What the Gita tells us is very true. In many ways, we are also like Arjuna. We have our battles. We also are caught always in the middle of war. You have your own wars to fight. I have my own wars to fight. But the truth, at the end of the day, do we have the time, the energy to consistently do the yoga as it is stated in chapter 6? It may sound very romantic. You know, sometimes our ideals are always romanticized. When we think of a place where we are quiet and peaceful, and we say that day will come, that day will come. But you and I know that day never comes. And when it comes just for a brief moment, and bang, you're back to work. Very difficult. So Arjuna asked a question which was relevant, and he brought up a point. The main difficulty of this yoga is that the nature of your mind cannot keep still. Have you all tried, ladies and gentlemen, to sit down for a while? Just do this with your mind. Tell your mind not to concentrate on something. And I guarantee you, the moment you say that, your mind will jump immediately to that object that you have just told your mind not to concentrate on. It happens to me all the time. I have an uncle. He's about 70 years old. He's been practicing this meditational yoga for the last 12 years. And he always tells me, I sit down for 2 hours and I'm so calm and peaceful that it is amazing. His grandchildren come and tell me at the back, you know what's happening? Grandfather's asleep for 2 hours. And when he wakes up, because we wake him up, then he realizes, oh, okay, you know, I'm up again. And then he tells everyone, you know what? I was really, really in constant meditation. The man was asleep. So, it's a fact. If we want to really apply the Gita, can this work? Because the mind is very difficult. You know what they say about the nature of the mind in Hindu scriptures? They have this story which is very interesting. There were 2 students of a spiritual master, a guru. They were crossing a river on the way back to see their spiritual master. When what happened was, they came across a girl who was seated on the side of the river bank and she was crying. It was late in the day. One of them goes up to her and says, "Sister, can I help you?" She says, "I'm crying because when I crossed the river in the morning, it was not full. But now its banks have burst and I can't cross over. High tide. And I need to get back to my village because my parents will be worried. How do I cross? I can't swim." Now, these 2 boys, teenagers actually, they had taken a vow of celibacy. that they were not supposed to engage with the opposite gender. So one of them hesitated because he thought how to help this girl. But the other, out of the innocence of his heart, said, I'll carry you across the river. So he carried her across the river and placed her at the end. And the two of them walked off. All throughout the walk back, the other person, who had not carried this girl, kept complaining and chiding this other brother of his. Why did you carry her? You were not supposed to. We are supposed to be yogis. We are not supposed to be touching. We are supposed to be regulated. Until they reached the ashram where the guru was. So guru asked them, what did you do today, my dear boys? So immediately this other boy, who had been complaining for the whole day, immediately he started telling his spiritual master, you know what? He has done something which is not correct. And he went on to speak about it. At the end of the whole conversation, the guru kept quiet. And then when he opened his mouth, he said, do you know something? He mentioned this to the two boys. One of you carried this girl on your shoulders and you left her at the banks of the river. The other one did not carry her at all on your shoulders. But throughout the trip and right up to now, you have carried her all the way in your mind. This is the problem with the mind. The mind is so powerful that we don't realize half the source of our problems are arising because of the mind. In Hindu scriptures, they have given examples of great yogis, great practitioners of this system of yoga, who have actually sat down and meditated for years and years, but who somehow or another, because of a moment distraction, lost all powers of their concentration. One of them is known as Shaubari Muni. Shaubari Muni in Bhagavatam, he was actually very powerful. He was supposed to be a very great muni, yogi, and he was performing great austerities for thousands of years, it is said. In the Hindus believe that the ages of our time can be calculated by cycles. And at one point, yogis were so powerful that they could extend their time. At that time, this sage was actually meditating in the water. He was underwater and meditating because he found land too much distraction. So what happened? At the point of his meditation, he was disturbed when he saw a pair of fishes in front of him actually mating. Just fishes, mating. Nature. And he got agitated at that point. And he came out of his meditation. And his meditation ended at that point. Another famous sage, Vishwamitra. We all know Vishwamitra. You know, he's a very powerful sage. But before he reached that point of his power, he had to undergo so many years of intense austerity. He had to forego his kingdom. He had to forego his family. And even then, in between his austerities, he was still prone to anger. And every time he failed at one point, he had to be set back in his quest to achieve peace of mind. Why the Gita brings this up is because if these great personalities found it difficult to concentrate, where would we stand when we have a much shorter lifespan and much less time to spare to spend time in yoga? So now the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna has given another formula for yoga. He says, alright, if Dhyana Yoga is a bit difficult to practice, if it's not practical daily, try this. This is the yoga of action. And it's completely different from what we always think, that we have to sit at the corner and meditate. No. This is a very revolutionary concept that the Gita puts forward. Why? Because the premise for Karma Yoga is in this verse. The Gita tells us that everyone is moving according to his active nature. Nobody can be still for a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, if I took this class for another half an hour more, or if I took this up to 8 o'clock, it would be amazing if you all kept still. Actually, you're a very good audience. You know, you're keeping very, very still. Normally when I give lectures, audience tend to be very restless. But today you're all very still. But the question is, how long can we keep still? By nature, we're very active. And even if we are physically still, our mind could be outside this room. It's entirely possible. It's possible the mind could be saying, when is he going to stop? We won't know. But the point is, at the end of the day, The mind is a difficult thing to stop because we can't stop activity. So, the Gita uses this idea of activity, and Krishna tells Arjuna in the Gita, activity is not bad, but there's a way to do it. So he tells Arjuna, Arjuna, you're going to be a warrior. You have assembled on the battlefield to fight. So, don't go into a cave and meditate, because you don't have the time. And anyway, it's your duty. You came here as a warrior, you must leave fighting. So then Arjuna was advised by Krishna, perform your prescribed duty, because it is better than not working. Why? Because you cannot even maintain your own physical body if you do not work, if you're not active. This has two meanings to us. One, yoga is eminently practical. Yoga doesn't tell you not to take care of your body. You have a right to take care of your body. But if you think your body is the be-all and end-all of your existence, then you must understand that is not entirely true. The Gita tells you that there is your mind, there is your consciousness, that needs to be taken care of also. So in Karma Yoga, you can work. Yogis who work very hard, you all may be lecturers, you may be students, but if you perform your duty as a student to the best that you can, then you are halfway through to becoming a yogi. That is a definition of yoga from the Gita. But the starting point of yoga is to actually work hard, and then when the results come from the work, you should renounce the results. This is the tricky part, isn't it? Because we work very hard and we are motivated naturally by results. You know, I have a project, I want to do well. Now you tell me I have to work very hard and then the result is not mine. Why am I working hard? But Krishna tells us, if you work hard, and if you work hard and get caught up by the results of your work, then you become either distressed one day or happy the other. How many of us have gone through that? We work very, very hard. At the end of the day, you pass your exams, you're very happy. Next day, you fail your exams, you're down in the dumps. But you're not stable. Either way, you are prone to being moved by your results. And you know as well as I know that whatever results you want in the world, 9 out of 10 times you don't achieve. Either because you are overambitious yourself, or the world is such, whatever you want, you don't get. That's the truth. The truth is, the Gita says, we work for everyone. Most of us have our motivations to work. Those who are married, have children, family, you work hard to take care of them. You have your own goals to achieve. The Gita tells you, just change the focus. Instead of working for your employer, God becomes your employer. Instead of just working for your family, put the Supreme Being God in the center and connect yourself to Him. The idea is that of watering the root of a plant. When you have a plant and you want to water it, the Gita tells you, if you water the flowers, the leaves, the branch and the tree trunk, not much help. But we water the root. Because the Gita's belief, like all religions' belief and all spiritual beliefs, is that the root and the creator of everyone is the Supreme Being. So you'll find that in the Gita, Arjuna was advised to fight. But he was told, fight and offer the results of your fight to God. And if you don't believe in God, what do? Some of us may ask now, if I don't believe in God, doesn't mean I can't practice yoga. You can. Krishna says you can. How do you do it? After performing your duty to the best that you can, renounce the results of the duty. The next question you'll ask, to whom? But if you can't believe in a Supreme Being, then at least make the act of renunciation your goal. I'll give you an example that is given. Simple story, but it's useful. In Hindu scriptures, there is a story about this hawk. It found a piece of meat on the ground and picked it up. As it was flying very high, hundreds of other hawks came in because meat was scarce and they wanted a spoil of what this hawk had got. So the hawk was very perturbed, disturbed. I worked hard. This meat belongs to me. It should be my fruit of my actions. So what am I doing? I don't want to give it to anyone. And amidst all that, the hawks kept biting, kept poking, kept harassing this hawk in the sky. And then after a while, the hawk realized, now I have this piece of meat, which I've obtained after hard work. At what cost? I'm being harassed by others. I thought this would bring me peace and happiness, but apparently not. So what should I do? This is what the hawk did. It just dropped the piece of meat and it flew away. By dropping the piece of meat, the hawk immediately was freed from the harassment of the other birds and it became peaceful. True, it lost a bit of meat, no doubt, but there's always another day, another meat, another time. So the yoga of karma is speaking about doing your work, but remembering one concept. You can work very hard, but the result of that hard work is not in your hands. Have you all found this to be true, ladies and gentlemen? Have you found the fact that I'm working, I'm putting in 10 hours of work in my assignment, he's putting in 10 hours of work in his assignment, how come I'm not getting the result he's getting? Of course, you could say he's smarter than you, but what makes him smarter than you? How come I have the same brain, he has the same brain, how come he has more intelligence? Who decides that? The world is not a fair place. The sooner we live with it, the better for us. You know, one of the great sages, one of the great saints, Srila Prabhupada, he says this nice point. He says, if everyone were to reap the rewards of what they worked for, then this world would be the most equal place to live in. Think about it. Then commensurate to your level of work, you will achieve the result you ought to get. But the truth is, we don't. Have you been frustrated when someone you know has not worked half as hard as you, but scores very well? Right? You feel like slapping him or her, isn't it? Very, very irritating. I remember I used to be like that in my junior college. I had this girl who was sitting next to me, and she made the best notes in class. You know, she had them all in color codes and everything. And I was always nice to her. And I was so nice to her that I could borrow her notes. And whenever I studied her notes for the exams, I always end up doing better than she did. And she used to get so fed up with me. By the way, I married this girl years later, so she's still with me. She's my wife. Just for info. But my point is, at the end of the day, right, the Gita tells us the world is not a fair place. Based on each person's reactions, each person's past reactions, each person's what we call karma in a different word, we all will have one result to one action. If you want to be stress-free, yoga tells you, renounce it. Do the best that you can. Then the next question is, how do I live with that? The way to live with it is, the Gita tells us, that the moment you have done your best, that conscience that you have in your heart, that I've given it my best, is what you carry with you. I don't know whether you had parents who were pushing you when you were young. My mother was a teacher, and I was in the same school with her. Nightmare. Right? She expected the best out of me. If I was second in class, I was finished. But every time I did badly, and she, not badly by my terms, badly according to her terms, and she used to chastise me about it. When I used to go to sleep, my father would come up to me, without my mother knowing, and tell me, it's not the end of the world. Why you worry? And I felt better then. And he always told me this point. He said, have you tried your best to your ability? You touch your heart and tell you, and ask yourself that. If you have done the best that your conscience will dictate, then you are free of the results. This is what Arjuna was told by Krishna to do. Fight to the best of your ability and leave it now to him. That's why the Gita says, effort is yours, result is God's. It is finally the Supreme Being who designates, based on your level of maturity, what you are going to receive. So the karma yogi is encouraged to work in a way where he's not entangled. Tricky, yeah? Requires a lot of practice. But it can be practical for one purpose. Why? We're all working. The platform is ready for us. No breathing exercises needed. Don't have to stand upside down on your head for the next 10 years of your life. You can work. And in that work, the secret of working to become free in your mind is given. Two things. That you work hard and leave the result to Him. What comes, you accept. But when you know you have not worked hard and your conscience is pricking you, then be true to that and work harder. Your work never suffers that way, but your mind is free. Initially, this cannot be done overnight, but it can be done through practice, like everything else in the world. Does it mean that we have to 24 hours think of renouncing all our activities? Is that what we are supposed to do? No. The Gita also tells us that is impracticable. There's a very interesting story. You find it very, very practical for us. There is a great sage in Hinduism known as Narada. You all know Narada. So what happened was, Narada went to see Lord Krishna, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. God. He went to see God. And he asked Him, I have given up everything for You. I must be one of Your greatest devotees. And Krishna said, no. And Narada said, why not? The whole point is to give up. I've given up. I've resigned from my work long time ago. I left my family, everything. And I'm always spending the day thinking of You. So who's greater than Me? And Krishna said, there is someone who's working on the fields, just a few hundred miles away. For Me, he's the greatest devotee. Narada said, you must be joking. How can this be? He's working, he's earning his living, he's taking care of his family. How can he be renounced? How can he remember You all the time? So Krishna said, why don't we go in disguise? Why don't we go and see him, find out how he lives his life? That's why I think he's the greatest yogi around. So they went to see him. This man was very normal, just like all of us. Working, he was a farmer, morning till night he was on the fields. But he was doing only one thing throughout his work. He was all the time trying to remember God, trying to remember the names of God, trying to remember always that whatever he was working for, he must offer the results, trying to be humble that in whatever I work, I have given it my best, and at the same time maintaining all persons who are under him, his family, his dependents, and everyone. So at the end of the day, Narada said, I still don't get it. He's got his leg in one part of the world and he hasn't renounced anything. How can you say that he is a yogi? So then Krishna told him, very simple, Narada, do one thing now. I'm going to give you a pot and there's going to be water in that pot. I want you to put it on your head and I'm going to draw a straight line about 10 meters down. You start walking from one end of the line to the other, but make sure you balance it in such a way that you're walking on the line and there's no water spilling. So Narada thought, alright, I still don't understand how I will come to know how this man is a great yogi, but I'll try it anyway. So he started walking, balancing. He ends the 10 meters, he puts the pot down, he says, there, Krishna, I've done it. So Krishna then asked him, let me ask you a question. When you were trying to balance this water on your head, how often did you think of me? And Narada said, that's a silly question. When I was balancing water on my head, how much time do you think I can think of you? Hardly anything. But I was trying my best to balance the water. And Krishna said, all this time, this man has been going in and out of work. But all that time, he's working. At the same time, he's trying to remember me. He's offering all the results to the best of his ability to me. And you couldn't remember me for 10 meters because you had water on your head that you had to balance. Which is more difficult? Why I'm saying this is, the Gita tells us that you do not have to become perfect beings to connect with the Supreme. The Supreme God is concerned about your effort, not the result. If your effort is good, like a kind father or a mother who is just happy that the child is trying, God also becomes happy with us and He gives us the strength to remember Him more, to become more fixed and responsible in our duties, and not to become entangled in anxiety and stress. This is the secret of work that Krishna is speaking about. It's a very interesting point, but it's very practical, because we can work and we are working, and nobody at this moment is going to go to any cave, as far as I remember or I can note. In the Bhagavad Gita, three very great examples of karma yogis are given. And they were much more successful than the jnana yogis or the dhyana yogis. And these are great kings. King Janaka was the father of Lord Ram. Oh no, sorry, Mother Sita. And King Yudhishthir was a very powerful and historically proven king, one of the Pandavas, and of course a great character from Mahabharata. King Ambarish was known to be the emperor of India, and at that time of the whole world, as they say. All these kings, it is described in our scriptures, were busy for the whole day. But throughout whatever that they were doing, the scriptures tell us, they constantly tried to remember that they were part and parcel of a whole. That their work was supposed to be for God. It is just a shift in attitude that Karma Yoga is asking for. Nothing more but a shift. So that's Karma Yoga. Now, let's end with the last yoga that Bhagavad Gita speaks about. And this is known as Bhakti Yoga. An entire chapter is devoted to Bhakti Yoga in the Bhagavad Gita. And the only qualification needed for this yoga is sincerity of purpose. Very interesting qualification. Very hard to define, very hard to calculate. You don't have to be fit physically. You could be retired, you could be working, it doesn't matter. You could be a yogi performing exercises if you want. You could be a student, could be a housewife, you could be anyone. But the only qualification needed to perform this yoga, to connect, to be free of stress and anxiety, is sincerity. And what is the sincerity? The sincerity is to remember the Lord with devotion and service. This yoga has 9 different ways in which you can perform it. And if you read about them, as you are seeing them, I'm sure, you'll find they're not so difficult. The first is to hear. That's what we're doing now. You are hearing about yoga from the Gita. Whether you realize it or not, at this moment, no one is particularly anxious. Unless, of course, you have another appointment and you feel you're going to get late. Or if you're hungry. But apart from that, at this moment, you are pretty much free of stress. Do you know why? You're not free of it because I'm speaking and you have to listen. You're free of it because the topic in which we are speaking is connected to the Supreme. And you can call the Supreme any name you want, but the point is, we are speaking about a higher topic. When you connect in hearing, speaking, remembering, something which is higher, something which is actually in touch with your real inner self, that brings you peace. That brings you freedom from anxiety. So you can hear about God. You can chant His names. You can remember Him. You can do service. There's so much charitable service in this world. People do so much for humanity. The reason for doing that, the Gita says, is that humanity is part and parcel of the Supreme God. And if you link that up, then that service is yoga. For those of us who go to temples, when we worship the deities lovingly, that is yoga. If we offer prayers lovingly, that is yoga. If we carry out the orders of the Bible, the Quran, any other spiritual literature, and even the Gita, that is also yoga. And if you serve the Lord, and if you accept Him as your friend, as your companion, then that is also yoga. And finally, if you perform some kind of sacrifice for Him, that is yoga. You are all sacrificing at this moment, even as we speak. And what are you sacrificing? Your time. You have invested 1.5 hours today of your time to hear about topics related to the Supreme. That is yoga. So Bhakti Yoga is very broad. It is very broad. And in one sense, it is very unconventional. But the beauty of it is, it can be performed by anyone without any qualification, regardless of caste, creed, religion, race. God is colorblind, as we say. You know? It doesn't make a difference to Him what color you are. After all, our blood is the same. But what matters is whether you have sincerity. You know, in the Ramayana, we have this very powerful personality known as Hanuman. You all must have heard about him. Hanuman was a great, great devotee of Lord Ram. He was a monkey actually. And he was serving God in the Ramayana. And God was always relating with him in the form of the King Ram. He treated Hanuman with great love. He never saw him as, you are a monkey, not qualified to come to me. Never did. And there is a verse, a prayer that Lord, that Hanuman sings, you know, to Lord Ram in the Ramayana. And that gives us the full idea of Bhakti Yoga. I'll try singing it to you. It's very nice. Na janmanunam mahato na saubhagam navang na buddhir na krite steshahetoho tairyad vrishishta na pino vanaukashah chakarasakye bata lakshmana grajah. What Hanuman, the monkey, is singing to Lord in the form of Lord Ram is this: I am just a monkey. I have no education. I don't have a degree. I am not very handsome to look at. Monkeys are not the most handsome people in the world. I don't have a house that I can invite you back to. I live in the forest, tree to tree. I don't speak your language, only gibberish. And I have no proper upbringing, no high parentage, nothing. But despite all my disqualifications, you have still accepted me as your friend. This is the qualification of Bhakti Yoga. Anyone can connect with the Supreme. Which is why Krishna concludes in Bhakti Yoga, as does Arjuna, that Bhakti Yoga is considered to be the highest yoga that you can actually utilize in your connection with God. Why? Highest doesn't mean most complicated. Highest should mean the simplest. Our idea of highest in this world is it must be the most elaborate and the most complicated. When you tell someone, you know what, yoga is so simple, you can do it now, they say, really? I don't believe you. The world is sold on something that appears complicated. But the truth is, do we want to really complicate our lives? The whole point is to simplify your life. It's very hard in this world to sell a simple product. Very easy to sell a complicated product. Because 9 out of 10 times, how many of you have gone for lectures, or gone for talks, and you have heard something so airy-fairy, and you come out and you speak to each other and say, you know what, that was so sophisticated. And when someone asks you, what was it all about? Actually, I'm not sure. But I just know it's sophisticated, you know. It must be something deep, that's why I don't know anything about it. But if it is deep, and you don't know anything about it, then how can it be practical? Something that is practical must be something you can go back now and start, and it should work. Otherwise, forget about it. You're wasting your time. So the highest yoga is Bhakti Yoga, and the verdict of the scriptures is that the simplest way to approach bhakti or love of God is what we call mantra yoga. Mantra, everyone has heard. It has a meaning. Man means the mind. Tra means that which the mind can rest on. So the resting place of the mind is mantra. The Buddhists have powerful mantras. The tantrics have powerful mantras. Even hymns that you chant in a church with love and devotion are considered as mantras. So what are they? They are connecting mediums between you and the Supreme. And when you chant the names of the Supreme, they are not only a medium, they are the means to the end. And they are also the end to itself. Which is why it is recommended that when you chant any powerful recommended mantra, and if you chant it peacefully, concentratedly, while doing your work, while performing your activities, until it becomes a part of your subconscious psyche, that actually purifies your senses. It allows your mind to become more controlled, and that is the aim of yoga. We all want to be happy, and that's the reason why we came here. It may not have been the fundamental reason at the beginning, but it is the deepest reason of all. Now the question the Gita answers, and we are ending, is this: what happens if I start yoga and all of a sudden I find I have lost interest, I've stopped it? What happens to me? The Gita has a very nice point. Krishna, in 3 of these verses, he tells Arjuna that even if a yogi attempts yoga, and that means karma yoga, meditational yoga, or bhakti yoga, if at some point he stops, it is not a loss. God is so kind that he sees where you have stopped, so to speak. And he allows this yogi to take birth again, because the Hindus believe in rebirth, to take birth again in a family where all facilities to continue where he has left off will be given. What I'm trying to say is, all of us are not born with degrees. Now, I got my LLB honors. You may have got your MBBS. When we die, we don't carry our degrees with us, unfortunately, after all the hard work. When we are born, the child isn't born immediately, he doesn't display his certificate. Oh, this is from my past birth. He doesn't. He has to start all over again. But the Gita gives us a very challenging concept. The Gita says, whatever you start in yoga, you carry with you where you stopped to your next life, and you continue. Life is a long journey, and in that journey, God gives you the chance to achieve perfection, life after life after life. If you ask me, that's a great concession. So how do you live in this world as a yogi? This is the conclusion of the Gita. Arjuna is told, and this verse actually is a combination of many yogas. You should think of me in the form of Krishna. At the same time, he says, you please carry on fighting. So let's paraphrase that. You should think of me, and at the same time, please carry on working. And if you dedicate the results of your work, then if you fix your mind and intelligence on me as the person to whom you want to offer, you will attain me. Me means supreme peace, without doubt. So the Gita concludes by telling you, any yoga that you take is good. But the greatest yogi, the Gita says, is one who has great faith and one who's always trying to take shelter of the Supreme, and one who renders loving service in the form of his work to him. He becomes most intimately united and he becomes the highest yogi. And Krishna concludes by saying, that is my opinion. So if you were to put all of this together, ladies and gentlemen, then I think we can find a common denominator for all the yogas. One, all of them tell us that we have to fix our mind on some form. Today it is fashionable. Most yoga systems tell us to fix our mind on nothing, on the formless. But try fixing your mind on something, it becomes easier. Imagine fixing your mind on darkness. You either sleep or you get a concussion. You can't sustain it because there is no form before you. The reason why you're even sitting down and hearing me is because I'm in form. Not in form as in top form, but I'm in form because I'm sitting before you. If I was hiding behind this and talking to you, chances are I'll come out and see all of you have left, because there's no form. It's a practical thing. Second, all yogas tell you, be prepared to renounce and sacrifice. Renunciation is not a bad word. It doesn't mean you go to the forest and leave your family members. When I started reading these books, my mother thought, he's not going to get married, he's not going to come home, he's going to leave everything and become a mendicant. I'm still here. Nothing has happened to me. I'm still fighting cases in court. I'm normal. Renunciation simply means renunciation in the heart and in the mind. Can you renounce something which is troubling you? If you can, through the process of yoga, you are successful. And sacrifice doesn't mean fire sacrifice. Sacrifice means of your time. When you love someone, how much time do you sacrifice for them? You know. How much do you get back from them? You also know. Is it worth it? Yes, you say. Why? Because I love that person. Yoga is about loving, cultivating a loving relationship with the Supreme. The sacrifice that the mother gives for a child, even if a child doesn't reciprocate, you ask mothers, why are you doing this? You know, sometimes you see people, you know, whose faces are only the face that a mother would love, that they would say, you know, how can a mother love someone like that? But a mother will tell you, he's my child. For good or for bad, he's mine. This should be the semblance of our mood in connecting in yoga. That somehow or another, we must be prepared to sacrifice for a higher cause. A higher cause. The third connection for all yogas is, there will always be a connection to a Supreme. You can do Hatha Yoga for good exercise, you can maintain good health. But you and I know good health is not maintained purely on bodily level. If you are stressed in your mind, your body fails. Your body is good and your mind is stressed out, your body also fails. Mind is the key to your health. And mind needs to be connected to a higher cause. And the last connector of all the yogas is that there must be some faith. And on the point of faith, I like to conclude by quoting what I always consider to be my favorite verse in the Gita. To those who worship — worship doesn't mean going to temple and pray only. Worship means in terms of work, in terms of time, in terms of thinking. Those who worship me with exclusive devotion, meditating on my form, to them I carry what they lack, and I preserve what they have. If you ask me, this is the supreme law of guarantee. Whatever you have, you don't lose. And what you don't have is given to you. If you ask me, this is a win-win deal. You don't lose anything by trying to connect. No loss. No loss. Have you all heard of the famous Mughal emperor in the 16th-15th century, Akbar? You must have heard of his great court jester, Birbal. One time, Akbar and Birbal, king and court jester, decided to travel the kingdom incognito. They were looking around and they were expecting to see something. After a whole day of traveling, they got lost in a forest and they were both hungry. Birbal decided to sit down and perform yoga. He said, At this time, I always perform my yoga of prayer. Let me chant. That is my mantra yoga. Let me meditate. Akbar said, you can meditate, but who's going to give you food? It's dinner time. You have to walk somewhere to get food, man. So Birbal said, I have faith that if I perform yoga, I will be peaceful and arrangements will be made. He said, all right, I will go and find food for myself. Let's see what happens. So Akbar went about and he finally found a house, kind people, gave him some food. As he was leaving, he thought, I should be kind to Birbal. Let me get him some food too. Comes back. Birbal has just finished his meditation. And Akbar said, see, you have to be pragmatic in life. You're sitting here and chanting, I went to get food. Now I've got food and I've got food for you. Birbal said, exactly. Because I meditated and I had faith in the Lord gave you the intelligence to pack some food for me and bring it here. That's what faith is about. You think about it. Any questions? Anything you'd like to raise? Please.
Myself, Nimai Mishra.
Yes.
I'm from the Holy Land, India, as it's called. So very specific, from West Bengal, very near to the Navadvip.
Are you in Mayapur?
Yes, I have been there. My hometown is very near to Mayapur.
Your name says that you are in Mayapur.
Yes. So it's birthplace of Lord Chaitanya.
Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
Last avatar of Lord Krishna.
Yes.
So actually, I don't know about the God.
Yes.
What is God? But I believe the thing is that these things, the Hindu spiritual things, can bring all of us in certain peace, yes. So we can concentrate. That's why maybe some supreme, maybe, I don't know.
Yes.
So a very personal question from me to you,
you may not be answered. Sure.
So what things happen actually in your life that brings to connect you to this purpose?
What happened in my life to connect me to this? I think the main factor that made me connect to this, Nimai, was the fact that when I was young, I noticed one thing about people around me, that they were always trying to be happy, but their happiness could not last. So that made me start thinking, is there anything here that will last? Because my idea was, if something is good, it must last. If it doesn't last, it will be replaced by something which is not peaceful. And I saw my parents going up and down in life. On some days, everything is good. Some days, everything is not good. And I begin to think that there must be something else here in which any facility in this world that may possibly give you that chance to attain some peace, some equilibrium in your heart. So that was my quest. And that's what got me more interested in reading, in trying to find out different ways, different kinds of faiths. That got me to read the Quran, that got me to read the Bible, that got me to spend time with Buddhist people of Buddhist faith, monks. So my spiritual quest started from my inquiry in my heart. So, and I also kept asking my mother, why must I go to temple? Why must I do this? Why must I do that? And mother could not give me satisfactory answers. And I thought, there must be a reason for me to do it. Otherwise, why do it? So then I began to think that if I want to approach this carefully, like my subjects that I'm studying in school, I should approach it with more seriousness. And that's how I began to become more serious. So through time, I found that, you know, something has come. Is that okay?
Yeah. So, can I answer this
please
from my perspective?
Please.
I am a professor of orthopedic and spinal surgery from Malaysia.
Right.
And I just come for the first time to this place. If I put up in this way, it's possibly because of the unfinished spiritual quest of your last life.
Perfect.
That has possibly given you an opportunity of your mind, of your parentage, of your social structure to get in touch. Because if you look into the present scenario of people becoming devotees at a much younger age, especially in this world of turmoil and materialistic quest, what the Gita says is that if you have unfinished work in your previous life, I give you an opportunity for you to possibly start where you actually see it within this situation. So I feel that everyone who's sitting here in this August hall has possibly done something great in the past life. That explains why a 70-year-old grandfather did not understand going to the temple.
True.
But his 7-year-old grandchild struggles and fights and goes down. The grandfather drives the car, puts in front of the temple, doesn't go inside. The grandson becomes a devotee. How do you explain that? How do you explain a boy is born with cerebral palsy or poliomyelitis in India, and the boy is born up in a rich family? How do you explain this? Even though you might be forceful in saying that, no, we don't believe in next life or previous life, but then we've got to understand that the great Bhagavad Gita is the most standard textbook on reincarnation, most standard textbook on evidence-based
perfect
understanding of faith and religion. And therefore, I feel that everyone should try to make an attempt. And as the great Srila Prabhupada has written up, the famous book of Bhagavad Gita has this very lucid and very simplistic way of putting
it.
Things.
It really is. It really is. When I was primary 6, I actually read this. And I found that it was so simple in language that I could actually get some understanding. I think professor has given you the perfect answer. I've given you an answer from a personal level based on where I came from. But you heard from the Gita and you've heard from the speaker of the Gita that each one of us is embarking on a journey of life. And no one here is here by accident. This is also the reason of your previous activities. Your quest, your curiosity, and where you take off is actually His mercy. And the product of your work. Thank you so much, Professor.
Well, fortunately, we do not remember that. If
yes.
We remember that, we'll be confused.
Oh, yeah.
The past life, I have been.
Oh, yes,
so
yes.
I have a right.
It's difficult.
That thing Krishna takes up.
Yes.
That forget.
And that is His mercy, actually.
But that's the reason why possibly we feel that you're surprised.
Why?
There are people who have changed their life of hearing one lecture.
Yes.
It is surprising that Nimai Mishra, who is just gone up from about 5 kilometers away from the famous Navadvip, possibly could not get the feel of Lord Krishna or Lord Chaitanya. And people as far as Malaysia, Singapore, Ireland, and America, Fiji, and all those, there is an interest. What more better example you can have?
True.
Right?
It's true. The examples are here. Yes. Sorry, she just asked the question.
Yes.
Then I'll take yours. Yes. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So, but if you say you can Buddha, he just did everything that Bhagavad Gita preached.
Yes. That's a good question. The question is a very relevant one to all of us. Buddhism and Hinduism both basically are in one sense sister religions. Whatever the life of Buddha was is actually completely that of the Bhagavad Gita. So then why is it that Buddhism has a thought flow that seems to move towards the direction of negating a supreme being, and Hinduism seems to have a different flow. The answer can be given based on two evidences which are found in the Shastras. One is in Bhagavad Gita and the other is in Bhagavatam. In Bhagavatam, the explanation that's given for this is the Hindus accept Lord Buddha as an incarnation of the Lord. That means he's as good as the Lord. At the point, the purpose of an incarnation, Bhagavatam tells us, is that the incarnation is normally given, the incarnation of the Lord descends himself for a particular purpose at a particular day and age. Lord Buddha came to establish Buddhism as a religion, Bhagavatam tells us, because at that period of time, the emphasis on rituals, the emphasis on ceremonies in Hinduism was fast overshadowing the principle of loving devotional service to the Supreme. You had Brahmanas who were exploiting their position, who were behaving as if everything in religion is about rituals. So the Lord descended as Lord Buddha, we are told from Bhagavatam, to move us away from the concept that religion and spirituality is ritualistic, and to bring us back to the most essential point of spiritual life, that until and unless we change the mode of our behavior, Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam and all Shastras will just be academic. If you notice, the whole point of Buddhism is about how to live the middle path, how to behave yourself. It is behavior that is exemplified. And Buddha did that for a specific purpose at that time, because it is very easy for us to get caught up in the rigmarole of religion, rituals, and worship, and forget that what is religion without change in behavior, without change in lifestyle? This is an important point that Buddha taught us. So in that sense, he is a true person. He is a true representative of the Gita. And his purpose in being in this world was very specific. So the next question that may be asked is, Buddhism relevant? Prabhupada explained the question very nicely. Any branch, any form, any road to God which is bona fide, which has been prescribed in the scriptures, and whom someone is taking up seriously, that person is already a devotee of God. Sometimes people used to come and see Prabhupada and ask him, I'm a Christian, can I change? And he would tell them, be the best Christian you can be. And that is following the principles of Gita. Is that all right? Yes. Yes, that is the Hinduism's point of view. Yes. Yes.
Attain supreme consciousness.
Yes.
And when you attain supreme consciousness,
yes,
everything becomes an action.
Yes.
It's manifested.
Yes.
So we need to say that if all of us attain supreme consciousness,
yes. Okay. That is where the difference in Bhagavatam's version of Buddhism and Buddhism as it is perceived today differs. Yes, please, if you want to say something, I can end off by speaking on that.
What exactly is happening that is ultimately speaking the design of Lord?
Yes.
You rightly say that at the time of the advent of Buddha,
yes,
the country was in turmoil by the Brahminical imperative.
Yes.
Yes. Buddha was born up in a very aristocratic family.
Yes.
And rightly said, the last word was fate. If you believe in fate,
yes,
the Bhagavatam says that the Buddha is the ninth incarnation of the Satyasavatar,
yes,
of Lord Vishnu. Basically, Buddhism is an offshoot of Hindu religion.
Yes.
It's very, 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 very recent. It starts from the birth of Buddha.
Yeah.
And it is very focused in folklore. In fact, at that point of time, when we found that the influence of Buddhism was almost rampant in India and other places, the Lord had made an arrangement by sending another of his devotee, who was an incarnation of Lord Shankara,
Shankaracharya,
as the famous Adi Shankaracharya, who can be labeled as the most famous Malabarian or Kerala, you see, who at the age of 20, by the age of 32 years, virtually gave to the world,
yes,
the entire concept of Brahman and brought them back from,
yes,
the theory of Buddhist voidism,
yes,
which was almost going to destroy the world. At that point of time,
yes,
bringing them back to the Vedas, bringing them back to the form of Hinduism that is now relevant. These are basically speaking points of time. Buddhism is an offshoot of Hinduism,
yes,
to be real sense. And at that point of time, it was Narin. That is what the students of religion believe.
Yes.
There is Narin.
Yes.
Now, Buddhism is most ideal. Islam is number one, or Hinduism are relevant, or Christianity is something. That's a question of academic debate.
Yes.
That's a question of faith per se.
Yes.
But individually speaking, even Buddha also teaches the love of God. Now the understanding of God has been more personified in the Srimad Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam, and it has been in one of the offshoot way of Nirvana religion in Buddhism. Fundamentally speaking,
impersonally.
In one way, it normally tells the same thing.
Yes.
But in a different way. It tells about the sunlight.
Yes.
We talk about the sun because we just identify the sun.
Yes.
For a common man, sunlight and sun is almost the same. If we ask our child, is the sun off? He says, looking at the light, yes. But we know that sunlight and the sun is not the same. But in practical sense, it's the same. But this is exactly what is the tenet. And the subsects are basically speaking, according to time and
place. And circumstances.
And
what is your name?
I'm sorry.
Soumya. Soumya, to just briefly, because time is of the essence here, to briefly address the point that you said. Finally, the Gita's message is also to raise within oneself the understanding of your own spiritual identity. We call it Swarup in Sanskrit. Buddhism also told us that you have to know that you are not this body. The only apparent difference, I use the word apparent, as Professor has said, is that in Buddhism the emphasis was on the self. But in the Bhagavad Gita, the emphasis is you can know your true identity in place with the supreme identity. So, this is not the forum in one sense, as Professor also said, to say whether this is a higher philosophy or a lower. But I would say that there are different levels of consciousness, and Buddhism is very much close to Hinduism, as you will find other religions are also, because the main point finally is that you have to come out of the idea that you are this body. And that's the starting point of any process of self-inquiry, that there is more to you than your flesh, your blood and your bones. I'll take one last question. Were you going to bring up something?
Yeah, actually,
please?
I have a couple of questions.
Okay.
The first one is about, you said that when you do yoga, I mean, let's...
Sorry, one last question. Just 1 minute. Are we going to be thrown out of the room?
No, no. Test questions are in 8:15.
Okay, that's fine.
We can continue. We can just go on.
Sure. That's why I asked, because I don't want to be thrown out of the room. Yes, please.
Yeah. When you do yoga, I'm thinking of, let's say, pranayama.
Yes.
So when I learned pranayama,
yes.
By the way, I'm a visiting faculty in mechanical engineering.
Okay.
Nursing one from Bangalore, IASC. So when I learned pranayama, what I was told by my guru, the person who taught me, is that I should try to relax the mind and not try to concentrate.
Yes.
And he said if you concentrate, it will only further stress you up.
Right.
So I learned pranayama and yoga with the idea of trying to relax.
Okay.
To de-stress.
Yes.
So, but you were mentioning that you should concentrate on something. But what I was told is that I should try to relax the mind.
Right.
There seems to be some contradiction.
Yes.
So that's my first question.
Okay.
The second question is something...
Can I take it one by one? I'm very bad with remembering all three questions and answering them. I'll forget your first question also. Your first question, the Bhagavad Gita tells us that concentration means, right? Concentration is not an arduous task. Concentrating on the Lord is actually a very blissful process. It actually allows you to de-stress yourself. Because by concentrating on the activities of spirit, we move away from matter. The mind's... The only way the Bhagavad Gita tells us that the mind can relax, even in the 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, is when it becomes focused not on the material energy surrounding it, but on the spiritual energy which is sustaining it. So when Guru Maharaj speaks about relaxing your mind, he's actually telling you to free your mind from the shackles of your daily lives, to elevate it, so to speak. In flowery language, that is what is being said. But in simple language, what you have been doing to relax your mind is a natural process of actually getting yourself